Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie here with John. How's it going, buddy?
Dude, I'm doing really good. How are you doing?
Good. You sound so much better.
It is amazing what the difference a couple of days can make.
It is. I'm glad you're feeling better and glad you're back with us. I'm glad to be here. We've had several weeks in a row of college students who have gone missing or been killed. And I said that was the end of our college run. And while I don't think the subject of today's case is a college student, she was of that age. So go ahead and get mad at me if you want. Well, a lot of 18 to 22 year old women, unfortunately, being hurt.
That's all right. It's a good case. It's a very interesting case. It has a lot of similarities to what we have been talking about. So I think it's going to be a good discussion. Before we get into that case, what about some ratings and reviews? Do you have any that you can read off for us today?
Yeah, this comes from Tessa Asset, and this says, "Greetings from Down Under. What a duo. Thank you for the respectful way you treat each case. Heartbreak knows no boundaries, and when it comes, the impact is gut-wrenching. You remind us beneath the surface of devastation, often there's a family who is reeling from losing someone who meant the world to them." Tessa, we really appreciate the review. That was also super well written. So if you want to write the new description for our Facebook page, maybe you should take a crack at that.
I would love, like absolutely love, if we had a fan-driven Facebook page.
Yeah.
I certainly don't want to be like a egomaniac, but I would have to say there are some fans out there that would want to do a Facebook page for us. That would be a great way for us to get some content out for you all and a great way for you all to be more interactive with us.
A place to talk about cases, to talk about the cases we cover, to argue with us, to argue with each other, or to come together in solace and talk about these victims and their families.
I have many strengths, but Facebook and other social media, not one of those. And that is one of my tasks here at True Crime Cast. So, hey, if you guys are on the market for wanting to help you boys do some Facebook, and just let me know.
Yeah. TikTok's a lot of fun. It just takes some time. So, yeah, would love for some help with social media.
Yeah, let us know.
Didn't think we were going to go there here in the pregame.
You know,
that's where we're at.
Live and unscripted is how this opening goes. I would like to tell you guys about Patreon as well. If you are looking for a way to get more interactive with us, there's a new chat feature over on Patreon that we can utilize. You can ask us questions, and as long as we are, you know, around our phone and have just a few minutes, we can live chat with our Patreon members. On top of all that, you also get the bonus episode each and every month and early ad-free content as well. Patreon is, you can get it for as little as $3 a month. That price has never increased. We have no plans on increasing that price. So go check it out.
Yeah, I'm learning about this live chat feature right now. So excited to interact in that way.
Well, spoiler alert, I have been chatting with people over there. So if you have been interacting with us on those chats, it's been me. And okay, Jamie has access, and I'll show him how to do that after this
today. I'll hop in now after John teaches me the technology. But
that's funny that's a sentence you said.
Yeah, I mean,
let's just be really transparent, shall we? Like, you have done something miraculous, Jamie.
What's that?
I am utilizing Google Drive now.
Yeah.
In a way that I never thought I would.
Yeah, it's useful, right? It's super helpful.
It is. I don't know why I didn't jump on this train sooner.
Yeah.
Sharing documents on the fly. They're not a sponsor, but boy, could they be. Google.
I don't think Google needs us.
Google, yeah.
We'll take their money.
If they notice a slight uptick, I assure you it's not our fault or doing. But yeah, it's been really helpful. We're working on a new season of Left Undead. Jamie and I are both writing episodes for that. We're like tag teaming that, and it's coming along really well. I think we have one more episode to write, and then the production starts.
Yeah, we got some more casting we need to do, so we're going to put some calls out for that, and it should be a good time. But yeah, I'm glad I work for a software company, so the fact that I'm the software guide in this, like, it's not a slight on you, it's what I do.
Yeah, and I've always claimed to be a low-tech redneck. I think when you're our age, you can either have went all in on computers at a young age or just chose to be old school. And I chose old school. You chose go in.
Yeah.
You were a hacker. You also started like a... you started fantasy wrestling before fantasy was even a thing.
Yeah.
It goes to show you just our generation is so split as far as technology.
I can't, like, you just called me a nerd about five different ways without saying the word, but no, that's appreciate right. it.
You guys didn't come here to hear us talk about what technology we like or dislike, but you did come for a crime story.
Yeah.
So what do you think?
Yeah. This is another tragic one. So several weeks in a row, we are going to mix it up. Next week will not be a young woman.
It will be a very historical case that everyone has heard of, but we're going to take a very deep dive into it.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, maybe even a two-parter.
Yeah.
We'll see how it goes.
A little assassination fun. But today we're talking about Megan Curl. John, get us rolling.
Megan Curl grew up in Lufkin, Texas. Isn't that like the most Texas name ever?
Lufkin. That's the most Texas thing I've heard.
She was a happy, outgoing child, but in the first grade, she was diagnosed with a mild learning disability. I don't want to go too far into this, but I mean, you know, you and I have experience with this. We have kids who have a harder time learning than some people.
Yeah. And, you know, it's nowadays a lot easier to get those things diagnosed and to get some of those needs met, but this happened a long time ago. So I'm actually surprised that she was able to be diagnosed, and it makes me wonder if it was a little more extreme having been diagnosed back then.
She was moved to special education courses, and according to her mother, Sherry, other children often picked on and made fun of Megan. She said, quote, "Megan wasn't always accepted. People would make fun of her and put her down, and she'd always come back with a kind word for them," end quote. So just goes to speak about Megan's character. She didn't let the bullying get to her. She responded with kindness in the face of adversity, and I love that.
Which is what you want to teach your kids to do, but man, it's a lot easier said than done. When Megan was 18 years old, she got married, and she moved to Arkansas. Her husband, though, was said to be abusive. It was an unhealthy relationship, and very thankful that Megan was able to get out of that relationship. A lot of people, it's a real struggle to separate yourself from that, and that's kind of the cycle of abuse. But she did leave a few years later and went back to Lufkin near her parents. When she came back, she got a job at a local chicken processing plant and insisted on getting her own apartment. Of course, her parents were thrilled to have her back in town. They were thrilled to see her out of that abusive relationship, and they wanted her to move back in with them. Her mom was not excited about her getting her own place. You know, I'm thinking ahead a few years to my kids, and if I can take care of you, if I can offer you something as an adult, I want to do that. And her mom wanted to do that. And part of it was because she felt like Megan was a little too trusting of people. That she was outgoing and she was friendly and she was open to meeting new people, but that sometimes made it easy to take advantage of her. And Sherry said this, because Megan was so trusting and so outgoing, she tended to be an easy target for some of these men. Men absolutely could tell that Megan wanted to please, that Megan wanted somebody to care for her, and that she was lonely. So Megan's mom, Sherry, wants her around, and she wants her taken care of, wants somebody to look after her, but she's an adult. So she got her own place nearby, and her parents had to just settle for being happy that she was back in Lufkin.
That's got to be a fine line for parents, right? Like, you want your kids to grow up and be independent, take care of themselves, but if you struggle in the ways that Megan does, it's sometimes not safe. And, you know, sometimes it's not safe for very healthy, sound-minded people, right, let alone if it's easy to take advantage of you. Megan was a big fan of nightclubs there in Lufkin. So on the night of March 25th, 2000, Megan went out to a local club called the Electric Cowboy. She was a regular there. She had many friends who would be there with her all the time. Jamie, I'm not going to lie, I'm pretty sure this must be like a franchise, because I'm almost certain there's an Electric Cowboy in some towns where I would frequent growing up.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of that?
I've never heard of the Electric Cowboy. I've heard of the movie Urban Cowboy, but everything you're saying, it just sounds like Texas is spewing out of your mouth.
Yeah, well, this is in Tennessee where I'm thinking of. I'm almost certain. I'll have to go back and double check. But anyway, March 25th, 2000, that's where she's going to be, is the Electric Cowboy. Now, on that particular night, her friends said that they saw her talking to a man that none of them knew. That man allegedly bought Megan two drinks while they were talking. And later in the evening, she was actually asked to leave the establishment because of her provocative dancing. I'm going to stop and process. How provocative do you have to be dancing at a nightclub to get kicked out? It must have been over the top.
Maybe it was. And maybe there was a misunderstanding, because I've very limited experience with nightclubs, but never been in a situation where a line was established, let alone crossed. So I'm not sure the details of what happened here, but she was asked to leave.
So there's a few stories of what happened next. She did leave the club. Some people indicate that she left the club alone. There were others that say that she left with the man who was buying her drinks. And one person said that she left with another unidentified man that was not the man buying her drinks. Regardless of that, we do know that Megan continued her night at another bar. It was down the street, and this one was called the Sport Shack. Now, she was also well known there. One of her friends who worked there drove Megan home around 1:30 in the morning, so almost doesn't really matter who she left the Electric Cowboy with, because we know that one of her friends drove her home at 1:30 in the morning.
Well, it may matter if they were around when she left the Sport Shack. This was around the time that you and I were ending our high school careers, and I know there were conversations when I got to college about taking care of your friends. We were starting to have more conversations about watching to make sure nobody put anything in their drinks and making sure that people got home okay. But I don't know that we have all the awareness, had all the awareness then that we have now. So I'm glad to see that she did have a friend that took her home and made sure that she was in a safe place back at her apartment. When we get back from the break, we'll talk about what happened at her apartment and the very reason we're telling the story here today.
Oh, hey there. You like true crime stories, right? Yeah, I know. Who doesn't? But I gotta admit, after a while, all those stories of murder and heartache, well, they tend to go straight to my hips. So that's why I, Leroy Luna, have created a podcast called Excuse Me, That's Illegal, where we'll take a hardcore look at some softcore crimes. No TED Talks on Bundy here. The letters BTK won't be coming from these lips. Unless he had a brother that used to steal library books. Suppose I'd be willing to go balls deep into that one if that were the case. Anyways, you'll hear stories such as the Mad Pooper, a female jogger who wreaked havoc in a Colorado Springs neighborhood, using one family's front yard as her own personal dumping grounds. If this kind of content sounds like it's up your alley, Excuse Me, That's Illegal is available right now on all your favorite podcatchers. So come join me. I'll be right here waiting for you.
Once Megan had gotten back to her apartment, her friend who drove her there, and this individual is asked to remain anonymous, so she's called Tanya in a lot of the stories that you'll read, but that's not her real name. She had waited up to hear about Megan's night out. So they stayed up and they talked out on Tanya's balcony. Megan was upset and started crying and saying that she really just wanted someone to love her. Her marriage didn't work out and she had been dating and going out, but still hadn't met somebody who truly cared about her. After about an hour, there was a car that went by, and Tanya said that this car sped into the parking lot and came to an abrupt stop. So if you picture somebody, they know where they're going, and they speed in, and they hit the brakes, and I'm here where I want to be. Now, Megan said that she thought this was a friend from the bar. So she went out, went downstairs to talk to the guy. Tanya went back into her apartment, and when she came back out to check on Megan, Megan had gotten inside of the car with this man. Tanya went back inside again, and when she came back, the car was still there, but Megan and the man were not. which if I was just telling the story and didn't know what's to come next, I would have assumed the car would have been gone and everyone else. The car still being there, super odd, but we'll get in more into that.
Around 2:20 in the morning, Tanya went to Megan's apartment just to check on her. When Megan answered the door, Tanya saw that there was a man in the apartment. Megan said, "I was right. It was my friend from the club." So Tanya looked down at the man and he looked up and just kind of nodded his head slowly back at her. Neither of them said a word to each other. Tanya turned back to Megan and asked, "Hey, are you really okay?" And Megan said that she was. So Tanya said goodnight and left.
Tanya really trying to be a good friend here and check up on Megan and continually asking her if she's okay. Now, I don't know how inebriated Megan was by this time or how able she was to actually tell Tanya if she was in trouble, but Tanya doing her best to try to make sure Megan's okay. And she does know she's back in her apartment. There is a strange man in there, but Megan says that he's with her. Around 4 a.m., Megan's neighbors saw flames coming from her apartment. Someone called for help, and the firefighters arrived really quickly. The fire was coming directly out of Megan's bedroom. And again, this was just over an hour and a half since Tanya had last seen her. The firefighters rushed in, and they were able to put the fire out pretty quickly before it burned the whole building down. But once it was put out, what they found was absolutely gruesome. Megan's body had been tied to her bed with pantyhose and a belt. She was charred beyond recognition, and they had to use dental records to positively identify her, even though they were pretty sure it was Megan. Underneath the fire, it was clear that she had been abused and potentially tortured before the fire was ever started. Her throat had been cut to the bone on both sides of her neck, nearly decapitating her, and she had a plastic bag over her head that was probably being used to suffocate her. This all happened when she was 26 years old. This brutal murder that took place within about an hour and a half, and then the bed was set on fire with her tied to it.
This is absolutely heartbreaking, dude, to hear something like this. My heart aches, of course, for Megan and her family, but Lord of mercy, man, could you imagine being a first responder and you're already walking into a bad situation, an apartment is on fire, but then when you get there, you discover probably one of the most brutal things your eyes have ever seen. The terror that these people go through each and every day for their jobs has to be overwhelming.
And as a loved one, you're always surprised to hear that something bad happens to somebody you really care about. But people were already worried about Megan. Tanya was really concerned about the man in her apartment. Sherry was worried about Megan living on her own. So I think there's something different when you're concerned that something might happen and then your nightmares come to fruition as opposed to just being shocked by a turn of events. I think it's a little different. And maybe, I'm not going to say it hurts worse, but it hits different.
Oh man, I mean, if I put myself in her parents' or her family's shoes and something like this happened to my child, I don't even know what I would be going through.
No.
It would just rip my heart out, and I don't know that I would ever let the anger subside. So authorities found a few things. They found remnants of a nightgown on Megan's body. And when they questioned her partners and her friends, they discovered that Megan typically wore a t-shirt and shorts to bed, and that really the only time she would ever wear a nightgown or a negligee is when she was planning on being intimate with someone. So you can kind of assume that this man that Tanya saw, there were intentions there for Megan to be intimate with him because of what she had on at the time of when they found her dead. Plus, there was no forced entry. So this led everyone to believe that Megan knew her murderer. And again, we know that Tanya saw a man in there. So investigators and Megan's family were certain that the killer was the man that Tanya saw Megan with earlier that night. The crazy thing is, even though people saw him, Tanya saw him, laid eyes on him, he has never been able to be identified.
And if he was the friend from the Electric Cowboy, then other friends had seen him. But you're right, they were never able to make an identification of his face or the vehicle they had parked in the parking lot. Authorities continued to talk to all of Megan's contacts, her friends, family, her coworkers, and they painted a picture of somebody they were really worried about, somebody that was very outgoing and lonely, so desperate to make friends and to have relationships, but also somebody that's very naive, an easy target, as Sherry put it, for men with bad intentions. Police commissioned a composite sketch of the man that Tanya saw in Megan's home, and they spread that out amongst the community. And the man had a white complexion, blonde hair, and a light mustache. He was wearing glasses with gold-colored frames. And they also put out a sketch of the man that was buying her drinks at the Electric Cowboy. He's not a suspect at this time. After talking to everybody, they weren't even sure it was the same person, but they do believe he could be a witness that could help them identify the man in the apartment. Police would like to talk to him to collect any clues to Megan's murder, to see if he saw her any more that evening, and maybe see if he could identify the man that was in her apartment. He's white or Hispanic with a dark complexion and dark hair, and he was wearing a cowboy hat when he was seen with her in the Electric Cowboy. So police still looking for these two unidentified men who may have had a role or at least known what happened to Megan.
Now, police did not want to get tunnel vision when it came to the man in the sketch, so they continued to question men from Megan's previous relationships, and that's when they came across a man named Tim Purvis. Now, Purvis had a reason to be mad at Megan. She had recently testified against him in an abuse case, and as a result, Purvis's parole was revoked. And dude, he had been out of jail for 1 week before Megan's murder. Now, he allegedly had a solid alibi, and there was no physical evidence that tied him to the murder. 3 years after the murder, Purvis fell off a water tower in a nearby town, and when EMS arrived, he refused any medical treatment, and he ended up later dying in his sleep as a result of those injuries. Now, you know how rumor mills get started, right? Some people speculate that this was actually suicide and that he jumped off that tower on purpose because of the guilt that he had for killing Megan. But there is absolutely no evidence to support that. It's just a wild rumor. But, you know, he does have a reason to be mad, but allegedly has a solid alibi.
Right. He has a reason to be mad. He has a violent past, but we know what he looks like, and we know what the sketch looks like, and those were not necessarily identical, to say the least. In 2012, there was a retired Lufkin police officer that said that he believed that he did know who killed Megan, but that they didn't have enough evidence to charge this person. John, we're dealing with that right now in our own community with the Brooklyn Farthing case that we've covered at our one-year anniversary of True Crime Cast a few years ago. And it's tough. We've seen cases go to trial when prosecutors didn't have enough to go on, and somebody can be found not guilty, be acquitted of a crime that we later find out they did commit, but due to double jeopardy laws, they can't be prosecuted. So police and prosecutors have to be sure they can prove what they're going to court to prove before they do it, or else they may miss their only chance. There are other rumors everywhere about what happened. There's some speculation online that this was not somebody that Megan knew, but somebody random that she had met that night at one of the two bars that she went to that followed up with her at her apartment. Her apartment, obviously nearby, Tanya's there. Some claim that this complete and total lack of concern about being seen by Tanya, he pulled up right in front of her apartment, he nodded to her through the door, probably indicates that she didn't know him. And if he was that certain that she didn't know him, then maybe Megan didn't know him well either. And it also points to the idea that maybe he wasn't going to be sticking around the area for a while.
You'd have to think that the police had to ask Tanya about this Purvis guy earlier. Like, Tanya, was this the guy that you saw in the apartment with Megan? And Megan, or Tanya rather, could have said, no, it's not him. So feel like there's probably some work like that being done that we just don't have the full answers to, because this is still an unsolved case.
And that's part of the investigation, right? They have to hold some things back, especially an active investigation. And a lot of the discussion about Purvis happened in the few years directly after Megan was murdered. The perpetrator, whoever it was, lit the body on fire, which drew attention to it. You would think that if somebody committed this murder and they wanted to buy themselves some time to slip away, then they would try to find a way for the body not to be found for quite some time. However, they were burning in order to get rid of evidence, one would think. So I think that may not be the case, that they were planning on leaving town, so they didn't care if she was found quickly. I think this was an attempt to bury evidence or to burn evidence, regardless of when the body was going to be found.
Yeah, it makes me think of about a local case here in Madison County, Kentucky, where there was a young lady who's missing. Now, you know, it's different than Megan's because Megan's body was found at the scene. In the case I'm referring to, there was no body, but there was a couch that was set on fire. And in my belief, that was an attempt to, like you said, cover up evidence, to destroy physical evidence of a sexual assault. And my investigative brain goes to that scenario here for Megan. Unfortunately, Megan's body is found at the scene. Just brutal. Megan's mother, Sherry, fell into a deep depression after the loss of her daughter. And I mean, like I said, my heart just breaks for Sherry. She still thinks about the last day that she saw Megan alive. Sherry said that they went out shopping that day. She was very excited to be able to have enough money left over after a payday to actually go out and buy some new clothes to go over and even get some makeup products as well. Sherry nearly gave in to her sadness, but said something happened to help her turn it around for her. She said that she had a sister, and I heard her come in after my daughter's funeral and told my husband, Sherry is not going to make it out of this. She's not going to come back from this. And hearing that, overhearing her sister say that, she decided to give her heart to God and told God to make out of this what he will. I'm going to make it out of this. So she did. She pulled herself out of the sadness. She admitted that she still struggled with the brutality of her daughter's murder. She would go on to say that just one of the things that the murderer did would have killed her, and they didn't have to do all three or four. She also didn't understand how someone could do what they did to Megan and keep that to themselves for so long. She believed that they would have had to have told somebody what was going on and what they had done. And I believe Sherry's right. I believe that somebody out there has probably heard from the murderer what they have done, or at least suspected somebody in what had happened to Megan. So Megan's mom, Sherry, says that all she wants is to one day know who killed Megan. And I know it was a long time ago. Shoot, man, it's almost 25 years ago at this point. I do think there's hope, but I think it is urgent that we find out soon.
Absolutely. And you noted that she pulled herself out of the sadness. To be clear, she pulled herself out of the debilitation that was coming with it and the inability to actually get up and live her life. And she turned that around to start living her life to give glory to God and to hopefully help find the individual that killed her daughter. Now, we have the sketch. You can find it online. Honestly, it's not one of the best, most helpful sketches that I've ever seen. It looks like if you said, draw me a random Texan in 2000, it would have been this sketch.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we're going to find anybody based on that. But if we find somebody based on something else, if somebody told a story, if somebody left a piece of evidence, if somebody, you know, was over in that apartment area that night, if we could match it up to the picture, now that's when it would be helpful.
I don't know if a person could have done something so brutal so long ago and one, hold that in inside and not tell somebody, or two, for that to have been an isolated occurrence.
Like right.
to have that kind of ability in your body to hurt somebody so bad, I cannot imagine it being an isolated incident. So I believe that this person has probably hurt multiple people. Now, maybe not killed somebody as brutally as Megan, but if you're capable of doing this, I don't think it starts and stops with one person.
Absolutely. This was very, like Megan's mom said, it was over the top. There were three or four different methods that he could have used to kill Megan, whether it was the bag over her face, cutting her throat, the fire. There were so many things that he did that stand alone could have done it. So,
and I think you need to look at each of those incidents as a separate MO in other crimes that remain unsolved. Like maybe this was the beginning of an escalation for this serial killer, if that is what it is. Again, I'm totally speculating. I mean, we see these brutal crimes, and when they're this brutal, it's rarely an isolated incident, or it's someone who knew her and was very angry with her.
Right. And there's evidence to suggest maybe it was somebody she knew, and almost as much evidence suggesting she didn't know this guy. So it's really hard to say in that way, but somebody knows this person. You're assuming he's mid to late 20s, maybe early 30s at the time that this happened, in his late 40s and his 50s now. Could be still around. You could know him. You could work with him. If you've ever heard anything about Megan's case, anything anybody said about being connected to her murder, please speak up. This is something that this family deserves to know, what happened to Megan, and you could be taking a killer off the street.
Yep. Jamie, this one is done, man. And I mean, as much as we talk about murder, I'm done talking about murders from like my young adult life.
Yeah.
These are hard. Like, 'cause I remember vividly doing the same things Megan was doing at this time of my life. I was going to Cotton Eye Joe's or the Electric Cowboy, and man, just brutal to think that something so tragic could happen to somebody that age.
And we were around
the prime of your life.
We were around that age during that era. So I think it certainly speaks close to us in that way. Next week, we're going to turn our attention to an assassination that has a lot of speculation around it as well. So I'm excited. I have probably obsessed too much over that case in the past, and going to get out some of my thoughts finally into a microphone. So make sure you stay tuned here for that.
Eager to hear it. Guys, we love you. And until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.